You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, Rolling Stone magazine recently updated its list of the 500 greatest songs of all time. More than half that list is new since the last time they did it. We'll break down who's in, who's out, and take your nominations for the greatest song ever. Now, a new report shows that no state in the country has a higher rate of imprisoning black adults than Wisconsin. According to the Sentencing Project, 1 in 36 black adults are behind bars in the state. While black people are only 6% of Wisconsin's overall population, they make up 42% of the state's prison population. On the national scale, black Americans are imprisoned at nearly 5 times the rate of white people here in Wisconsin. That is 12 times that of white people. In addition, the report says black people face disproportionate arrest rates and other factors that contribute to longer prison terms. We're going to dive into what's going on and what a group based in Milwaukee is doing to help former inmates transition back into society. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to this report? What do you think it would take to bring Wisconsin in line, at least with other states? If you're black, have you or someone you know been arrested or imprisoned? What do you want people to understand about that? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Claire Amari is a reporting fellow at Wisconsin Watch. She wrote about that report on the racial disparity in Wisconsin's prisons. Claire, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much.
For starters, this report comes from the Sentencing Project. Can you tell us a little bit about that project?
Sure. The Sentencing Project is an organization based in Washington, D.C. They promote effective responses to crime that both minimize imprisonment and promote racial, economic, and gender justice. The study that we're talking about is something they did on racial and ethnic disparities in state prisons nationwide.
There have been reports about racial gaps in the state's criminal justice system and in many other ways in the state. You talked to a lot of people and got responses from people working in these fields. What was their response to this report that puts Wisconsin top or, I guess, worst in the nation when it comes to this disparity?
Shocked but not surprised is what I would say. You know, it's a known fact that there are big racial disparities in the Wisconsin criminal justice system. I think what really took people by surprise was that Wisconsin has the highest rate nationwide.
How do we compare, say, to our neighboring Midwestern states? Obviously still a higher rate, but are we kind of on a par or do we stand out even among our neighbors?
You know, the report found actually that states in the upper Midwest tended to have larger disparities than states elsewhere, the upper Midwest and to some extent the Northeast. So, you know, Wisconsin being at the top of that list. I would say that the next highest state in Iowa, the next highest rate of incarceration of black people in the Midwest is in Iowa. That's 1 in 48 black adults in Iowa is imprisoned, compared, of course, to 1 in 36 in Wisconsin.
Talking to Claire Amari, reporting fellow at Wisconsin Watch, looking at a new report showing racial disparity in incarceration here in Wisconsin, the biggest such gap in the entire country among states. Claire, what are some of the ideas out there about why Wisconsin?
Yeah, so it's not entirely clear, why Wisconsin is differentiated from other states. What I did find was some states, particularly in the South, the racial disparities between the number of white and black people incarcerated, those disparities are smaller because they incarcerate not only a lot of black people, but a lot of white people too. And that's not the case in Wisconsin. Wisconsin, you know, does not incarcerate white people at the rate of some other states. And what other people told me was that, you know, there are just racist elements in the criminal justice system nationwide, or I should say at least racial, you know, differences in the outcomes of the criminal justice system nationwide. And Wisconsin has those too.
What kind of suggestions did you run into when it came to possible solutions to trying to tackle this disparity?
Sure. Well, the Sentencing Project had three big ones. The first one was they suggested that mandatory minimum sentences be eliminated. They said that those limit the discretion of impartial judges, and disproportionately, we find that people of color have longer sentences. The second thing, I thought this was quite interesting, they required they said that Wisconsin should require prospective and retroactive racial impact statements for all criminal laws. So that basically means a study of how a law will or does affect different racial groups. And they said, you know, states should repeal laws that are found to disproportionately affect people of color. The third thing was that they recommended decriminalizing low-level drug offenses. These accumulate disproportionately in communities of color, and they generally just drive increased involvement in the criminal justice system.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Louis is driving through Wisconsin right now. Louis, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I was listening to your show. It's pretty interesting. I just said it's like the elephant in the room, you know. There's something that's not slight to touch on, but I'm thinking that maybe it's not a racial issue. It's maybe it's a cultural issue. I don't think it's an inherent biological trait that some people of color are more prone to have crime in their life, but because of socialization or inculturation processes that their generations have been through and what they've had to go through, I think that they are more prone to be in these situations, and that the only way out of there is through education and job, better jobs.
Louis, thanks for the call. Claire, one theory that people might bring up, as Louis is pointing to, maybe the disparities are in rates of crime committed. Did the Sentencing Project report look at that or address that?
They did not, but what they did address was the fact that rates of imprisonment, you know, there are so many different factors that contribute to that. Everything from, as you know, as the caller was saying, you know, education levels, employment, poverty basically really drives high levels of imprisonment. And so one way to address this problem would be to address those outside factors as well.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. You also looked, Claire, at Wisconsin's legislature and the governor. Are there efforts out there to do some of the things recommended by the Sentencing Project when it comes to reducing the number of people incarcerated and reducing that that racial gap?
So there were no efforts being made at this time that were specifically in line with the Sentencing Project's recommendations, but there were some definitely incremental steps that we're trying to take to reduce this problem. I spoke with Representative Evan Goyke about Assembly Bill 69, which passed the Assembly and is now before the state Senate. This is a bill that would allow low-level, nonviolent offenders, including people with convictions for drug possession, to get their records expunged. That's important because there are over 200 professions in Wisconsin where you cannot get licensed if you have a criminal record. And as we know, you know, lack of employment, underemployment is a driving factor in imprisonment. So by making it possible for more people to get their records expunged, we would find hopefully that fewer people would be likely to return to prison.
And Claire, as we wrap up, what are you watching for next on this story?
Yeah, I think one thing that definitely is important is getting as many voices at the table as possible. And that means the voices of people who were, you know, or even are currently incarcerated. What is that experience like? You know, this can't be a conversation that's just being had, you know, in the halls of Congress. This can't be a conversation that's just being had between privileged people who've never been in prison before. This is something that, you know, everyone needs to contribute to.
Claire, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Claire Amari is a reporting fellow at Wisconsin Watch. We talked to her about her piece on racial disparities in Wisconsin prisons. Again, the state imprisons one in every 36 black adults, the highest rate in the nation. Coming up, we'll hear from a Milwaukee group about how they help people reenter society after getting out of prison. It's an effort led by ex-inmates. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this your story if you were locked up? What was it like when you were released? What was the hardest adjustment you had to make? What would have helped you the most? If that's you or someone in your family, love to hear from you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're talking about a new report that says Wisconsin has the highest imprisonment rate of black adults in the country. According to the Sentencing Project, 1 in 36 black adults is behind bars in the state, highest rate in the nation. Our next guest says it's a slap in the face, but he's working on changes. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If this is your story, if you or someone in your family has been incarcerated, love to hear your experiences transitioning to life after prison. What do you wish you knew then that you know now? What would have helped you make that transition? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ramiah Whiteside is the prison in-reach organizer for Expo. That's Ex-Incarcerated People Organizing. They're based in Milwaukee and have chapters around the state. They help people reenter society after being released. Ramiah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
You were quoted as saying this report on Wisconsin's black prison population was a slap in the face. What shocked you about that?
Well, at the end of the day, I think it was surprising because you look at these types of statistics, like, you know, some of our bigger municipalities, New York, maybe California, or bigger areas, maybe down by Texas. So you think of the good Midwestern approach to things, it just wouldn't be our backyard. And this time it is. And I think I got caught with my blinders on, because if we have small successes over in this area, you tend to think that these small successes are a bigger representation of what's happening at large. And in this case, it wasn't.
What small successes have you seen, Ramiah, that we could maybe build on?
So one of the things, of course, me being a directly impacted person, since I've come home, there are a lot of elected officials on both sides of the aisle interested in the lived experience of a person like myself who has basically grown up in the system. So that's one win going forward, a small win that we can definitely expand on, because they're listening. They're having us come to the table to share our lived experience in order to legislate and craft laws that are more indicative of our zip codes, our demographic.
Let's talk about one end of the problem here as people leave prison. And that's a lot of what that you've experienced yourself. You work with people making that transition. What are some of the maybe easiest ways that we can make a difference to help make sure that people leave prison and stay out of prison?
Well, that's a good question. First and foremost, I think the best approach when we're discussing reentry is not waiting until the very last minute to start initiating programs that we're going to use during transition. So the first thing I would do if I had the ability to do it was start the reentry process on day one, not day 4,751. So if that makes sense, you start changing that construct, you start changing that mindset on day one, right after you get sentenced, or right after you're in the county jail or house of correction, or right when you go through intake at Dodge. That is when you start the reentry process. So then you have 6 months, 6 years, or 20 years of being reacclimated back into the society. And it's not like a last minute hustle and bustle, which, again, cramming for an exam never really works.
Looking at the other end of things now, you've talked in the media about your own experience getting into crime at an early age. Was there a point when you look back and where you think, if I'd had this message or if I'd had this intervention, it could have turned that path away from prison?
I think what is different today versus back when I was waived at the age of 17 is the amount and the quality of resources, the wraparound services. So back when I was waived, back in the early 90s, like, if you had a relentless approach in the schools, in the community, and within your family or communal construct to save our youth, meaning it's constant, because here's the fact, okay? The bad guys or the negative behaviors out there are 100% all the time, 24/7. So our approach to combat that has to be 100% all the time, 24/7. So those wraparound services, they kind of have to be receptive and on your radar at all times, not necessarily in your face, but on your radar at all times. So the youth, when they look up with certain life challenges, they can and see lifeguards right before them, right there.
Talking to Ramiah Whiteside, prison in-reach organizer for Ex-Incarcerated People Organizing, or Expo. It's a Milwaukee-based group with groups around the state that helps people reenter society after being released from prison. Talk about this after a new report on racial disparities and imprisonment in Wisconsin in particular, leading the nation in that gap. Ramaya, I wanted to ask you about your in-reach work for Expo. What kind of things do you do when you are in contact with people who are currently incarcerated?
One of the biggest platforms that we are currently engaged in is basically voter education. So all things political, from the local ballot all the way up to the national level. So what I found during my tenure of incarceration was it's a lot of time to really see how our systems work and get educated on that. So now having that as part of my backdrop, I know that if you send information on the inside, people will read it. They'll dissect it. They'll take it apart. They'll ask questions. And then they'll also share the information that they learned with their loved ones, with their communities. So with InReach, basically, it's, you know, social studies 101. We don't even have social studies classes in our high schools anymore. So what we typically do is provide that information and educate our people on the inside. So then that ripple effect would hit their people on the outside who are out here in the community.
And then what kind of things do you do at Expo for that person who is maybe cramming for that exam, like you said, as they're getting ready to leave prison and adjust to a new life?
Well, one of the biggest things we do is, for one, that cramming analogy, that is unacceptable for Expo. So therefore, what we do is we onboard people while they're still incarcerated. So whether you have 6 years to do or 60 days to do, we want to have conversations with you to help connect you with some of these resources out here that you are definitely going to need as you transition. So then when you actually get out on that Tuesday or that Friday and, you know, you have a lot of questions and you need some direction, you can come down to the office. And we've literally taken people from point A to point B because they don't even know how to ride the city's buses anymore. So again, we get the information to them ahead of time. So it's you're not as shell shocked when you do transition out here. And we want them to recognize, coming from a trusted messenger, that me, I've been there. So that helps me be a trusted and authenticated messenger to assist people and support people with navigating this grid out here.
With the judicial system now, the criminal justice system in particular, are there cases where you think, yes, that Black person is treated differently than that white person for the same crime, whether we're talking about teenagers or grownups? What kind of, and if so, what kind of changes do you want to see?
I think if we could ever take the ethnicity out of it, so I'll just direct that narrative. So we're all, I believe, one race. I think we have different ethnicities. So that's a big difference. So if you take the ethnic part off the grid, I think we would have a better approach to adding up the mitigating or extenuating factors with any particular case. However, because we it's been ingrained in us to have this implicit bias. It's been ingrained in us to have these different systemic biases. We need to get that out of our judicial system. We need to get that off of our prosecutor's grid. And we also need to get that out of our defense attorney's approach. So nationally, we know, and even by this report, it's been confirmed that we have a psyche when we look at, you know, a young Black male or a young Black woman. We have to get rid of that. The only way we get rid of that is really reintroducing ourselves to each other. You know, so that takes conversations on a community level. That takes conversations between those disenfranchised zip codes and our judicial system.
We had heard from a caller earlier on who talked about the importance of education and local jobs in the communities that you're talking about, the hardest hit zip codes or blocks, however you want to define it. Are there interventions you're hoping for, Ramaya?
Well, there's always room for improvement. In order to get to where we need to go, we all have to speak the same language. We all have to be on the same page. The only way to do that is on the ground level, start having these conversations. Again, I'll reiterate, I've had conversations with elected officials. I've had conversations with chief DAs that traditionally, historically, I would have never had back in the days. I was a bad guy, so it wouldn't have happened. I was adverse to the system. Now, let's get some microphones on the ground to have that exchange outside of an election year. Let's have those exchanges. And many of our officials actually do that. We need to do that more so we can reconnect with this generation that's coming ahead, who has been disclosed and disenfranchised even socially due to the pandemic. They're even worse at odds because they're behind a year plus with socialization skills. You know, Zoom can't do everything. There's something about being social with your people that you can't get from a Zoom. So reconnecting and just basically starting some of those conversations all over again.
Your group works with and is led by people who were incarcerated. Do you have a message for people who maybe just left prison in the last month or year about how they can get involved?
Well, we do have the information on all our social media, so they can definitely look up expowisconsin.org. We have Twitter, Facebook, all the social medias on there. We have an office in Milwaukee, office in Madison, as well as local chapters around the state. So they could, you know, Google it, it'll come up. And my only message for anybody out there navigating this grid of reentry and transition that I would say to them is reach out to our chapter, reach out to a similar or like-minded organization and ask questions. Reach out before you think that you're alone and nobody's out here to support you or assist you or be one of your biggest cheerleaders. Make those calls or make those inquiries because you'll find out there are a lot of very good-natured and kind-hearted professional people out here with lived experience who will assist you and support you to get you over that hump. That's the gist of what we do because there's more of us out here who are successful than I think people really realize. And that's a part of people investing in us in the community who you wouldn't even think invest in us in the community.
It's a good place to leave it. Ramaya, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Thank you.
Ramaya Whiteside is the Prison InReach Core Organizer for the group EXPO. That stands for Ex-Incarcerated People Organizing. We talked to them about how they help former inmates transition back into society. Earlier, we had a conversation with Claire Amari of Wisconsin Watch. She wrote about the disproportionate number of Black adults in state prisons. Wisconsin, the biggest gap in the country. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. That's the Queen of Soul, Aretha Franklin, and the 1962 song Respect, recently crowned number one in Rolling Stone magazine's list of the 500 greatest songs of all time. Rolling Stone created the original list back in 2004. Now, for the first time in almost two decades, they've updated it, replacing more than half of the list with new songs. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What's your number one greatest song of all time? You could even give us two. What do you love about it? What makes a song the greatest of all time? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your song. You can also post over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Alexander Shashko is a lecturer in the Department of Afro-American Studies at UW-Madison, frequent guest here on Central Time on All Matters Musical. Alexander, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rob. It's nice to be back.
This was a big update. A lot of turnover in these songs. As you look and compare the list, what were some of the big trends in the kinds of songs that came in and went out?
Well, I think in terms of the songs that came in, obviously you had a lot of new songs from the last 15 years or so, and that's not surprising since a lot of great music has been produced over the last 15 years, and it makes sense that they would be included. And then it's not just the songs from the last 15 years, but it's arguably the songs from kind of 1980 and beyond, which gain a little bit more traction on this list than on the previous list. And that makes a lot of sense, too, when you consider that the voters who are choosing these songs is always changing, and you have a generation of writers, critics, artists, and industry folks who are all coming from a younger generation than before, and so they're going to be more interested in the music of their youth or the music of their young adulthood, or maybe not so young adulthood, but they're paying attention. And so that really changes some of the dynamic of the list, and that is great. That's part of what these ever-changing lists are all about. I think you see an increase in the amount of hip hop, although we can talk in a moment about this, perhaps not as much as there should be. And I think there's a change in the gender ratio of the list, that there are more women on the list and there are more women near the top of the list. And that is a welcome transformation of the list as well. So those are all those three are sort of the big changes that I see on the list. In terms of the omissions, Well, not surprisingly, some of the older music that was on previous lists has fallen off. In particular, a lot of the songs of the 1950s, some of which were really, really big songs, are no longer on the list or have dropped precipitously on the list itself. And you even have quite a few big anthems from the 1960s that either dropped a lot on the list or came off of the list. So that is one significant change. You also have, in general, a little more R&B, certainly hip hop, towards the top of the list, and some of the big rock songs that were at the top falling further down the list as it has changed over the years.
We got a taste of the new number one, Respect by Aretha Franklin. I want to give a listen to the old number one. It dropped to number four. Here it is. So Bob Dylan, Like a Rolling Stone, dropped from number one to number four. If there was a cliche, Alexander, of a Rolling Stone number one song pick, I think Like a Rolling Stone would be it. I remember there was a parody issue of Rolling Stone where it was Bob Dylan on the cover with Like a Rolling Stone reference. I don't know. What do you think about that change from what I would consider sort of the old model Rolling Stone top list to this one?
Well, I think that the fact that you have three African-American artists at the top of the list is a recognition from the voters that African-American music is central to American music, that it is the foundation upon which all of this popular music is really built, R&B, soul, funk, rock and roll, hip hop, you name it. And I think that the change and the shift that you see on the list is attempting to acknowledge that in some way by putting these tremendous songs at the very top. Number four is no slouch for Bob Dylan, given especially that it came out in 1965. And I think that there has been a shift, certainly since the 1990s, in which, arguably even maybe a little earlier than that, in which rock and roll's central place in the story of American popular music has receded a little bit. And so my guess is that having it end up at number four is something of a recognition of that transformation.
Talking to UW-Madison's Alexander Shashko, looking at the new list from Rolling Stone magazine, the 500 best songs ever, as voted by a lot of people in the industry, musicians, music writers, and more. What about you? What is your number one best song of all time? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. No judgment if we disagree. 800-642-1234 is the number, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Alexander, if you were going to start rating number one songs, like, what criteria would you even start to do? I don't know how I would start. What would be at the top of your mind to try to pick and quantify the greatest songs?
Well, of course, it can't be quantified. So creating the numbers is always controversial by definition, since there's no true way to quantify this. But what I would say is that you'd want a song that caught people's attention when it happened. In other words, a song that has some kind of resonance in the moment that it was released, but also something that has stood the test of time, a song that continues to be resonant and popular over time. It's a song generally that is easily recognizable, something that folks don't forget, which is, of course, connected to it being resonant over time. You know, when you're starting to talk about elite songs at the very top, the music's got to be amazing and the lyrics have to be amazing. It really, one or the other is not going to cut it. And that's, I think, part of what unites all of the songs that are near the top of this list. And then, you know, the historical resonance is important too. Where is this song in terms of its deeper meaning in American society? And that's where the greatest part of this list comes in. And I do want to note that when the voters were asked to write these lists, they were asked to write their 50 favorite songs. And to me, that's a little bit different than talking about the greatest songs, and something does get lost in translation there. Now, I completely acknowledge that many of the voters may not have made that distinction in any meaningful way, but to talk about something that is your favorite is something that you particularly like or that you find, you know, sort of preferred over anything else, whereas something that is the greatest is something that you consider of sort of a quality or eminence that is above normal or above average. And I'm sure people kept that in mind as well, but I am a little curious about how the list turned out, because folks were asked to list their favorite, and then the list was promoted as being the greatest. And, you know, maybe the greatest really should be just what people like the most. But the historian in me, and that's, of course, what I do, has some questions about that, because, you know, to be a historian and to be a historian of music is also to acknowledge why a song matters, not just whether I love it.
It's Brianna, caller now at 800-642-1234. Marcus is with us in Milwaukee. Marcus, hi.
Hi. So I would say for criteria, that it should, whatever the message is in the song should be a more towards a timeless message, I feel personally. And because of that, I'd go with All Along the Watchtower, but Jimi Hendrix version, even though it was written by Dylan. And with the whole Dylan thing, I'm surprised that he didn't fall more, being that there's charges similar to, I mean, not as severe as the R. Kelly thing, but, you know, I wonder how much that's going to be taken into consideration, you know, moving forward for artists and stuff, too.
I'm not aware of the Dylan story, but a couple points there. First of all Along the Watchtower, the Jimi Hendrix version, cover of the Dylan written song, Alexander. I don't have the whole list in front of me because 500 songs, but I imagine right. A fair amount of people might put that up there.
Yeah, it's actually in the top 50. So it is, I think, right around 45 or 40 or something like that. And it is a tremendous song. I mean, it's a song, again, that has incredible historical relevance to the Vietnam era. And the fact that it is written by Dylan and, you know, performed by Hendrix obviously makes it all that more power, much more powerful. And in fact, if you think about a lot of the songs that are near the top or in the top 50, one thing that I noticed is that quite a few of them are building off of the work of more than one tremendous artist. So Aretha's Respect, you know, was written by Otis Redding. Fight the Power, Public Enemy, is built off of a lot of samples, including the Isley Brothers. You know, they're taking the title from the Isley Brothers, Fight the Power. Smells Like Teen Spirit is inspired by the Pixies. So there are a lot of ways in which these songs near the top kind of have a little extra energy to them because of the way in which they are building off of the foundation of something that's already pretty great. And I think that All Along the Watchtower certainly fits within that category.
Let's go now to Katie with us in Sturgeon Bay. Katie, hello.
Hi.
What do you got for us, Katie?
Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, From the Beginning.
Yeah. So I got to say, I had the trilogy album. I wore the grooves out of that on vinyl when I was a kid. Why does that song stand out for you, Katie?
It was such a tumultuous time. I was a teenager when that came out, and just questions, why are we here? You know, the Vietnam War, of course, it was winding down, but it was a soul-searching song.
Interesting. Katie, I love that. Thank you so much for sharing that. And Alexander, I think it's going to be true for a lot of people. If you ask us our favorite song, it's going to have a lot to do with where we were and when we were when we heard it.
Absolutely. I mean, when you're young, in many cases, the music that you're listening to is part of how you shape your identity, your own sense of self. It's connected to deep memories that you may have of family or first experiences. And that only, you know, continues to happen throughout the rest of your life, even if it's not necessarily as profound as it is when you're young. So those personal experiences are absolutely part of what makes a song a favorite, right? What makes a song meaningful to any given person. And that's why this list changes, because as a different group of people are voting, almost no matter how much they're trying to think in terms of the broad sweep of history, their own personal biases, their own personal experiences are going to play into it. I mean, if they only ask you to pick 50 out of the 500, you're going to leave a lot of songs out that are important or even meaningful to you in an attempt to come up with a list. And that certainly is the experience I'm guessing that most of the voters had.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Alexander Shashko from UW-Madison. He's with us to talk about Rolling Stone magazine's update to their 500 greatest songs of all time list. You can join in with your greatest song of all time at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Share a song and why it's great to you. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation, hear from more of you coming up on Central Time.
Fight the power. Fight the power. Fight the power.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Fight the Power There by Public Enemy, the number two song on Rolling Stone magazine's new list of the 500 greatest songs of all time. Alexander Shashko from UW-Madison stays with us, and you can share your pick, whatever standard you want to use for your greatest of all time. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go back to your calls now. Scott is with us in Franklin. Scott, hi.
Hi. I think a really good song that needs a nod here is Bohemian Rhapsody by Queen, having topped the charts at the time it was released, and then made it back up to number one again decades later because of its roles in some movies in the 90s.
Yeah, some staying power right there. And Scott, is it apart from the staying power, is it a personal favorite of yours?
It's definitely within my top 10.
Excellent. Thank you for bringing that up, Scott. The staying power, Alexander, it wasn't just a hit then, but it's something that came back maybe even for new generations.
Absolutely. And Bohemian Rhapsody's in the top 20. So I think that is confirmation of it. Yeah, exactly. That experience. The fact that the song has continued to emerge as a fan favorite time and time again means that different generations of listeners are experiencing it in a way that they find appealing, that they connect to in some meaningful way. And if you look at several of these songs near the top, certainly that is a similar kind of dynamic. Marvin Gaye's What's Going On is a song that continues to be resonant in terms of social movements. The same goes for Sam Cooke's A Change Is Gonna Come and Public Enemy's Fight the Power, for that matter. You also have a song like Fleetwood Mac's Dreams, which is in the top 10. And I don't think it's a coincidence that that song is particularly resonant right at this moment, that it has been viral on TikTok over the past year. Fleetwood Mac have been getting a lot of attention, and the song stands on its own. You know, there's no question it would be a song that would be somewhere near the top regardless, but it undoubtedly has been helped by the fact that it was in the air at the moment. And sometimes songs like that gain in popularity because of the second, third, or fourth life that they live.
Thanks a lot for the call, Scott, at 800-642-1234. We'll go to Amanda now in Green Bay. Amanda, hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
What's your song, Amanda?
Oh, it'd have to be Bridge Over Troubled Water by Simon and Garfunkel. Oh.
And is that a song that's like had meaning for you, maybe even at different parts of your life?
Absolutely. Different meaning. I was born in the 50s. I'm a child of the 60s. So certainly I remember when the song came out, but it's grown to take on different meanings through the cycle of my life. I'm now in my 60s. So it's a bit more poignant for me than it was when it first came out. I think in the beginning, I was just caught up by the amazing lyrics of Paul Simon and the soaring, gorgeous vocals by Art Garfunkel.
Amanda, thank you so much for sharing that with us. And that there it is again. Somebody earlier mentioned, Alexander, timelessness, something that isn't just of its time. And this is a song for Amanda that can take on new and different meanings as she goes through her life.
And I think that's a song that is particularly well suited to that, because Bridge Over Troubled Water is a song about friendship. It's certainly can apply to anyone who's thinking about a relationship, a romantic relationship, but it's also about friendship. It's about the people around you. It's about trying to help one another get up and get through. And that's something that you have to manage in every phase of your life, right? At every moment in your life, you have to think about how you're going to get to the next point, right? How you're going to get through the day. And that song has always provided that kind of comfort and reassurance to people. So it doesn't surprise me at all that it would fit into that kind of setting. God Only Knows by the Beach Boys, another example of a song that I think fits that kind of dynamic for people. So yeah, those songs that matter to people in their personal lives are really going to stick over time.
Amanda, thanks a lot for sharing that with us. We're talking to Alexander Shashko from UW-Madison, looking at the new Rolling Stone list of the 500 best songs of all time, updated from their 2004 list. Many, many changes. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Mike is with us now in Milwaukee. Mike, hi.
Howdy. You know, I really love uplifting songs. So one of the songs that really
I was listening to a lot of rock and blues, and then I heard Van Morrison's Caravan on the Moondance album. And oh my goodness, what the beautiful production, the horns, the strings, the in quotation marks, chick singers in the background. The chick singers happened to be Whitney Houston's mom and her aunt and another woman that were in the band and a group together. On that whole album, that's Whitney Houston's mom. And then also the Allman Brothers' Blue Sky with the gorgeous sound of the harmonizing Les Pauls. Oh, my goodness. And then the lyrics are so just a beautiful, soaring, uplifting music.
Mike, you sound uplifted just like talking and thinking about those songs.
Absolutely.
I love it. Thank you so much for sharing. We seek out, Alexander, a lot of different things in music. Uplift, certainly up there. Do you see a lot of this kind of uplifting music in this top 500?
It's certainly there. I mean, you know, Van Morrison is there. Mystic is on there. And that kind of represents, you know, a big part of what he has represented to fans for a long time, which is this sense of transcendence, right? This kind of getting to a higher place through his music and through the feel that his music presents. You know, a song as straightforward as I Want to Hold Your Hand by the Beatles, right? I mean, that's a song that just brings joy to people. Outkast's Hey Ya, which is in the top 10, another song that makes people happy, even though if you listen carefully to the lyrics of that one, it's not that happy, but it makes people happy to listen to it. So yeah, that sense of joy in the music is often what drives people to love music, right? It gives them an escape from whatever pain they might be feeling in the world. It gives them a sense of joy, entertainment, and of being able to experience something for a couple minutes that maybe gets you away from everything else going on in your ordinary life.
Thanks a lot for sharing those with us. We'll go to Liz now in La Crosse. Liz, hi.
Hi, I wanted to share the song All Too Well by Taylor Swift. I think she's really just someone who's really one of the greatest female artists of our generation. And she's come out with several new albums recently, and she's re-releasing the Red album that All Too Well is on. And I think she just poured so much heart and emotion into that song. And it's really one of my favorites of hers.
Thank you for sharing that with us, Liz. Taylor Swift appears on this, Alexander. I don't think she was around for the 2004 or not showing up there. Can you talk about Taylor Swift in our last minute or so?
Well, All Too Well is on the list. It's in the top 100. It's her highest ranked song on the list. She has two, Blank Space is the other. And, you know, that song is just a powerhouse breakup song. And we're going to get the 10-minute version of it on the re-release of Red. So we're going to get the original version of it before she cut it down for the album originally. And, you know, I think what makes Taylor Swift so much a part of the canon already and likely to become more of the canon on whenever the next list is, you know, is that she's a very classic songwriter. I mean, she writes melodies and she writes songs from personal experience, but that often have kind of universal themes, and the lyrics are often adaptable to other people's experience. And so, you know, she's obviously caught the attention of an entire generation of listeners, and without any question, they've grown up with her and her music, and her music very self-consciously attempts to kind of gauge each of those eras and each of those phases of life. So, you know, when a song makes the list from Taylor Swift, it's not just about the one song, but what she represents for all of those fans.
Thanks for the call. Alexander, a moment you may have been dreading. Can you give us a couple of the songs on your top 10 list?
Well, I thought about that. If I had to come up with three or four that would vie for number one, I'll be honest with you, Aretha's Respect would be right up there. Mm-hmm. I think it was a really great choice at number one. The others I would think about are The Message by Grandmaster Flash and The Furious Five. If you're going to pick a hip hop song, I think that's the one that I would put at number one, although Public Enemy, no slouch either. And then the other two I would consider are Johnny Be Good by Chuck Berry, because it's just so important historically, and Papa's Got a Brand New Bag by James Ooh. Brown, because it really transformed how soul and funk music would sound for decades beyond it. So those are the ones I would put right up near the top.
Love it. Alexander, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Alexander Shashko from UW-Madison looking at the greatest songs of all time. We'll go out with number 20 on the new Rolling Stone list, Robin and Dancing on My Own. This is Central Time.